Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Everyday Heroes, we look at the lesser-known people who have shaped history. Then we revisit the American Revolution through the story of the Loyalists, those who fought on the side of Great Britain. Finally, we'll explore the historic and current efforts to amend the U.S. Constitution. We know the role of presidents and other leaders in shaping history, but we hear little about the unsung heroes, many who have risked their lives to liberate and rescue others. Who might some of those secret heroes be? We're joined by Paul Martin, journalist, editor, and author of Secret Heroes, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World. Welcome, Paul Martin. Often thousands are forgotten for the good they've done in making societies better, and you pulled a few out and wrote about them in your book.
That's right. I've always had a lifelong fascination with unsung heroes. I've kept a file for years on these characters when I come across them in my reading or see something on television. When I decided to do a book, I tried to pull out 30 of the most interesting, offering a really broad range of time periods and backgrounds, occupations, and so forth. And the mix that I have is just filled with people that ought to be better known. I mean, there's Hercules Mulligan, who is a tailor in New York City during the Revolutionary War, and he was recruited as a spy. And on two occasions, since he had British officers as customers, he learned about plots to waylay General Washington and was able to warn him and very possibly save his life.
Wasn't his brother also involved?
Was also involved. In fact, his brother was a conduit for another outstanding thing that Mulligan did, and that is he literally converted Alexander Hamilton to the American cause. Hamilton was born in the Caribbean, and he had grown up. He was a loyal British subject, and when he came to study in New York, he went to King's College, which is today's Columbia University. And he needed a place to stay, and he contacted Hercules Mulligan's brother, who referred him on to Hercules, and Alexander Hamilton stayed with Mulligan. And through the course of evenings conversations with Mulligan and his friends, Hamilton was won over to the American cause and became, you know, a real leader.
One of the characters that I thought was most interesting and that I hadn't known as much about as I would have liked to was Mary Elizabeth Bowser, who played a huge role in the Civil War. Tell us about her and her impact on the Civil War.
She was born a slave in Richmond, Virginia. Her master was a hardware merchant in Richmond, and he actually sold off Bowser's family, her mother and father and brother and sister. His name was John Van Loo, and when he died, his daughter, Elizabeth Van Loo, bought back Bowser's family and gave them all their freedom. And Elizabeth Van Loo sent Mary Bowser to Philadelphia to be educated. Bowser came back to Richmond just as the Civil War was starting, and when the Civil War began, Elizabeth Van Loo formed a spy ring for the Union. She recruited Mary Bowser because she was a rarity. She was a former slave, an African-American who was educated, could read and write, which was obviously a rarity at that time. And Van Loo was able to place her in the White House of the Confederacy, the home of Jefferson Davis and his wife and children. Bowser was a family servant, and she took care of Jefferson Davis's children and served meals, cleaned up afterwards. Well, as far as Davis knew, she was an illiterate slave, and he and his officers spoke openly in front of her. She also had a photographic memory, and Davis would leave his papers strewn around on his desk, and she could just, at a glance, pick up all sorts of information about Southern troop movements and finances and so forth. She relayed those on to the Union. She was recognized in 1995 as one of the most important spies for the Union cause during the Civil War.
How was she able to convey that information?
There were some fascinating ways. They would hide messages in like a basket full of eggs. They would hollow out one of the eggs and put messages inside the egg. And another way was they would put it in the shoes of a slave, and the Southerners were disdainful and wouldn't, you know, want to have anything to do with the slaves and their clothing, and so they were able to get things past the Southern soldiers. So it was an amazing display of bravery for 2 years to be by herself, right, as I said, in the lion's den. It turned out that she discovered so many secrets that they began to suspect that there was a mole somewhere in the White House of the Confederacy, and so she fled. She was there for 2 years, and her last act was she tried to burn down the White House of the Confederacy. She wasn't successful, but she fled in 1864 and was never heard of again. She disappeared from history.
There were three other women that I thought were particularly interesting in your book. Anne Royal was one, Grace Abbott, and Inez Boisevain.
Yes, all three of those I'd never heard of. And in fact, I could say I think all but one or two of the characters in my book I'd never heard of, and I wasn't familiar with even the ones that I had heard of. For instance, Hedy Lamarr, I didn't know that the achievements she did that were totally unknown to the public. But the three persons that you mentioned, Anne Royal was just this fabulous character. She was born on the frontier and survived Indian attacks, and she ended up marrying an older man who was quite wealthy. And when he died, she traveled around a bit, and she was well-to-do. But then her husband's family overturned the will, and she was left absolutely penniless at the age of 54. So she decided she'd become a writer, and she started writing travel books, and she wrote one novel. She lived hand to mouth the whole time. And then she went to Washington, D.C., and when she was in her 60s, she began a newspaper, and she was a terror. She was the first muckraker in American journalism, and she would traipse around the halls of Congress and government offices and just buttonhole officials and grill them. She would print everything, you know, she found, and she had very strong opinions. She was adamantly for the separation of church and state, and she was just a holy terror.
I think you mentioned that people still study her in journalism schools.
They do. She's regarded as the first of the muckrakers. She's really the first investigative journalist in early history of journalism. Journalism often was advertised in her PR almost, and she really dug for the truth and was fearless. And she made so many enemies that the U.S. Post Office stopped delivering her newspaper because she made so many enemies on Capitol Hill. So she started a second newspaper and delivered it on her own. And of course, she never had a very wide circulation or never made any money. In fact, she died, I think she had a total of 6 cents when she died, but her influence was tremendous.
And then the other two really interesting women, Grace Abbott and Inez Boisevain, had to have a little bit more of a similar impact.
Grace Abbott is just someone that you never hear of, and the woman was absolutely amazing. She grew up in Nebraska and was trained as a teacher, and she went to Chicago and studied at the University of Chicago, and then she became involved in protecting immigrants. And for 9 years, she ran the Immigrant Protective League. And then she was recruited to the U.S. Children's Bureau, which at that time was a federal office to overlook the rights of the interests of children. And she improved the lives of millions of people through information she distributed on maternal health care and infant health care. Even then, and still today, the infant mortality rate in this country is really shocking. We have 4 times the infant mortality rate of Japan today. And she did so much to protect the children. The other thing she did was she was instrumental in writing the child labor provisions of the Social Security Act. And she also wrote child labor provisions in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was passed in 1938. Unbelievably, there was still exploitative child labor up to 1938, but afterwards, when that law was passed, we finally ended that shameful period of our history. The other person you mentioned, Inez Boisevain, she was a colorful character. She was one of the few characters in the book who grew up in a wealthy family, and she had a privileged upbringing. She went to Vassar College, but she was a real rebel, and she was in the forefront of the women's suffrage movement, and she made speeches on campus, and as I said in the book, I think the people at Vassar probably threw themselves a party when she finally graduated. But she went on to New York, and she got a law degree at New York University, and one of the first things she did was investigate the horrible prison conditions at Sing Sing, and she wrote a report, and it resulted in widespread reforms. And she literally gave her life for the cause. She was speaking in the western half of the United States, trying to get passage of universal women's suffrage, and she collapsed on stage in Los Angeles, and it turned out she had pernicious anemia, which today is very treatable, but back then it wasn't, and she ended up dying, and so she was a martyr to her cause.
And only 30 years old.
Exactly. And they told her if she cut back and, you know, stopped exerting herself, she could probably weather this health issue, but she refused to. She literally gave her life for the cause.
And then if we were to move up in time, there are two other people. They're very different. One was Golden Rule Jones, who was very interesting, and the other was Kirk Bloodsworth.
Golden Rule Jones, of course, was a progressive leader during the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century. He grew up poor, and he got into the oil business, and he started his own company and made a fortune. He moved to Ohio and started Ohio Oil, which was bought out by Standard Oil, and so he became quite wealthy. But he had a tragedy in his life. His wife and one of his children passed away. He remarried, and his second wife lived in Toledo. So he moved to Toledo, and he started a company to produce oil drilling equipment. It had the memorable name of the Acme Sucker Rod Company. And he was 50 years ahead of his time. He instituted an 8-hour workday. He refused to use child labor. I mean, this was all before, while these things were going on, he was doing these things on his own. He gave Christmas bonuses, paid vacations. He built a park and playground for his employees. And his whole point of view was that everyone should live by the golden rule. I mean, it was very simple, and that's the way he treated his employees, and they responded with incredible loyalty. Well, he became famous for this, and they started around Toledo, started calling him Golden Rule Jones, and then he was put up for election by the Republicans and for mayor of Toledo, and he won. And the amazing thing was that when he started introducing the same kinds of reforms that he'd done in his company to city government, the Republicans were up in arms. Business interests, they thought, you know, that this was not the way to go. So the next election for mayor, they kicked him to the side, and he ran as an independent, and he won with 70% of the vote, and he was reelected three other times. He died in office when he was 54, but he was a real progressive, and he was one of the people who brought us things that we accept today. Everyone thinks that a 40-hour work week and paid vacations are the right of all Americans, but if it wasn't for people like Samuel Jones, that just wouldn't have happened. The other person you mentioned, Kirk Bloodsworth, he's interesting for several reasons. One, he's the only living character of the 30 people I write about. He's still alive. He grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland. His family was, they were watermen. He grew up crabbing and oystering, helping his dad on his boat. And he joined the Marines, and after the Marines, he married a woman who lived in Essex, Maryland, which is a suburb of Baltimore. And at the very time that he settled in Essex, a 9-year-old girl was brutally raped and murdered, and Kirk Bloodsworth was arrested for this. He had nothing to do with it. He was completely innocent. And he was convicted basically on the testimony of a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old who said they saw him. Well, he spent 9 years in prison. He was convicted and given the death sentence, and he was sent to prison in Baltimore, the state prison penitentiary. His death sentence was overturned. He was given 2 life terms. And to while away the time, I mean, to keep himself sane, he would read a lot in the prison library, and he happened to read a book about DNA profiling, which was perfected in 1984 by a professor in Leicester, England, and a light bulb went on, and Bloodsworth said, well, this could be used to prove I was not the killer. And it just happened that his attorney had asked that all the evidence in the case be saved, and it was sent to a lab in California and tested, and he was exonerated and set free after 9 years in prison. He was the first death row inmate to be set free by DNA testing in this country.
And then he went on and made it part of his cause.
He did. He was instrumental in getting the Innocence Protection Act and the testing portion of that act, which any convicted prisoner is tested for DNA now. Their DNA is recorded, and that test is named in Bloodsworth's honor.
Well, Paul Martin, thank you so much, and thank you for honoring the everyday Americans who shape our world. The book, again, is called Secret Heroes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Who were the tens of thousands of people who remained loyal to Britain during the American Revolutionary War, and what happened to them? Among the one quarter of all American colonists who decided to stay loyal to the king in 1776, there were at least 20,000 slaves and free people of African descent. Where did they go after the war? And what do their stories tell us about American history? We're joined by Harvard history professor Maya Jasanoff, and we're talking about her latest book, Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary War. Welcome, Maya Jasanoff.
Great to speak with you.
It's great to have you. So you have been looking at this aspect of American and British history that hasn't been looked at really very closely, and that is that there was a very large, what we call loyalist community, that is people that were loyal to the British crown, during the American Revolution. And it wasn't really a small number. Tell us about this community.
A lot of Americans don't realize that our revolution was really a civil war. It was our first civil war. And it was a war that divided people up and down the colonies as they were then around the question of whether to be independent. And so for the average American at the beginning of the American Revolution, the default position was actually to stay loyal to Britain. And up to maybe a third of Americans are believed to have being loyal to Britain throughout the war, not necessarily gone along with the patriot vision of independence and freedom and so on that we think of as having been so widespread in retrospect. But for them, really, staying with the status quo, staying with Britain was something that was very powerful and important to them.
That brings up a few questions. One is really the role of people like Thomas Paine, who allegedly was this person who reframed the entire idea of independence and revolution in a way that made it seem honorable rather than treasonous. So apparently it didn't work with all people. Why do you think that is?
I think that Thomas Paine, who was himself British, did do something amazing for Americans, as did Thomas Jefferson in the opening of the Declaration of Independence. And I think that they put a language to the cause of independence that had not been there before and that really gave American patriots a rhetorical advantage over Britain in the Revolution. That said, rhetoric is not the same as daily life, and it doesn't put food on your table, and it doesn't look after your family, and it doesn't govern the kinds of relationships that you have in your home, in your business, and all the rest of it. And so I think for many people living in the colonies at that time, while this rhetoric was very, very seductive and obviously went on to have a great resonance in and beyond our nation, there was still a powerful sense of the ways in which they wanted to have lives for themselves that could have profit and could have political coherence and could protect them from threats around the world. And those were all goals that many Americans continued to see held out for them in the crown of Britain and remaining part of the British Empire.
You noted that a lot of the people were members of the Anglican Church. Many of them were connected to the imperialists. But there were other kinds of loyalists there as well. It seemed like there was a diversity of them, including the people of African descent, something like you said, 20,000 slaves, and also free people of African descent. Talk about the various kinds of loyalists, so-called loyalists, and
sure,
their various reasons.
We in America usually think of loyalists as having belonged to a very small elite, as having been predominantly white men in positions of power, Anglican, strong ties to Britain, wealthy for the most part. This was, in fact, only a subset of who loyalists were, just as it was only a subset of who Americans were. And one of the things that is really important to know about loyalism at this time is that it cut right across the spectrum of early America. It cut across the ethnic spectrum, the geographical spectrum, the religious spectrum, and the spectrum of occupations and all the rest of it. So people had their own reasons for staying loyal that could come out of belief, pragmatic calculation, and also opportunities. And this is where the story of group of African Americans called the Black Loyalists is particularly fascinating and important, I think, for us to look at. We know that in the United States there was this wonderful language of freedom, independence, liberty, that celebrated by Paine and Jefferson and Moore, but it didn't extend, of course, to the 500,000 slaves who were held in the U.S. at that time. Instead, many of them saw liberty offered to them by the British Empire. And early in the war, just a few months after the American Revolution began, British commanders began issuing promises to patriot-owned slaves in Virginia and elsewhere, telling them that if they came and joined the British, then they would get freedom in exchange for doing that. And so for them, the promise of liberty was really held out by Britain and the Empire, and about 20,000 black slaves ended up joining the British, and a good half of them survived the war and ended up being evacuated in freedom at the war's end to live out liberty in the British world.
And there were also several thousand of the free people of African descent as well.
Yes, and in particular, these slaves who became free as a result of British promises. And British commanders really, in quite an admirable gesture that I think has been neglected by historians, really stuck up for the freedom of these people in the face of great American opposition. And in fact, George Washington himself confronted the British commander at the end of the war, saying, "You guys are taking away our property," as he saw the former slaves. And the British commander stood up and said, "Look, you know, these are free people, and I'm not going to take their freedom away from them." And George Washington was very put out by this. Not least, some of his own former slaves went off into the British Empire and had new lives. But the fact is that Washington's vision of freedom and liberty did not apply to and did not extend to these formerly enslaved people.
So given the extent of the people that were loyalists, you said it was one third of the people settling in America. That's a huge number. And so what accounts for, you've got the British Army, which was very strong. You've got one third of the people living there siding with the British Army, and they still lost.
Yes, it is one of the great what-if questions in certainly British imperial history. There are really a couple of things that account for why loyalists didn't win the day. And I do think that that rhetorical advantage that the U.S. had was very powerful. And I also think, and this comes back to the issue of civil war, at the end of the day, British people living in Britain and colonists of British extraction living in the 13 colonies shared more than divided them. And when faced with this potentially protracted, bloody, divisive war, I think many people on both sides really had a kind of lack of will to keep fighting it out when they could find ways to redefine the relationship peacefully. So by the time the Americans had this kind of coherent sense of who they were going to be, the British were interested in trying to find a kind of common ground with what became the United States.
Now, here in the U.S., we are taught about the spirit of 76. You talk about the spirit of 1783. Tell us about that.
So one of the great paradoxes about the American Revolution is that Britain lost this war. It was the biggest loss of territory for the British Empire until the era of World War II, until the whole empire fell apart in the 20th century. And yet, it was Britain, not the United States, that went on to be the big world power throughout the 19th century, up until, in fact, about World War II. So how could it be that Britain lost these colonies, these closest possessions, very valuable culturally and politically, nevertheless go on to kind of new heights? And the answer, I suggest, is that they took away lessons from losing in America. And those lessons, I think, were summed up in what I call the spirit of 1783. And they included a new sense, really, of how to manage relations between the government and the people, and to manage them in ways that meant that people of all kinds of religions and ethnicities living all around the world could find a place within the hierarchy of the empire. They would have liberty up to a point. They would be held in check by institutions of the crown and its officers. And in this kind of balance, you saw a form of government that actually proved remarkably resilient and successful. around the world. And it was the experience of having lost the colonies where this kind of balance didn't work out for Britain that helped them figure out where to go next and come up with what turned out to be a very successful formula moving forward into the 19th and 20th centuries.
It worked for a little while.
150-odd years is not so bad as a run of things at the top of the world.
And so I understand that this loyalism versus patriotism really did break up families, communities, other relations. How prevalent was this kind of division that occurred?
I think it was a lot more prevalent than we generally think, again. And the best example of this kind of division can be found in one of our founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, whose own son, William Franklin, ended up being a very powerful leading loyalist, as important to the loyalist community as Benjamin Franklin was to the patriot community. And here was a rift between father and son created by the war. And so while Benjamin Franklin was managing American affairs diplomatically through the war and ultimately negotiated the peace settlement that defined U.S. independence, William Franklin was arrested by the Patriots, jailed for some time, spent time in British-occupied New York City organizing Loyalist resistance to Patriot forces, and ended up spending the end of the war himself in exile in Britain and ending up on the losing side. But the passions that were ignited by this war were, I think, very strong, and the principles people had in the case of the Franklins, you know, could be very powerful, and it really could divide even this very close father and son. We tend to think of ourselves as having always been a very united people, but to remember the ways in which we weren't always united is very important for us as we live through an era of seeming partisanship in our country today.
The big question that arose for me is how this history impacts our understanding of historic America and the founding of America. What would you say the impact is?
There are two aspects to this that I really believe are important. One is that America really was based on wonderful principles and promises and rhetoric. And yet, we have never been a monolithic society. We have always been a society with many, many voices, very plural, very multi-ethnic. I believe that that's very much a source of our strength, but it's also, of course, been a source of tension historically right the way through our national history, the Civil War being a great example. So the importance of remembering that even at the outset, we had all kinds of divisions might make it easier for us somehow to accept that we're going to continue to be divided, and that's part of what makes us who we are. We share some values, we're going to debate them, and we're going to fight about them, and that's part of what we're about. The second point is also very important for America right now, and that is that we have long really been proud of what makes our national history so special and so distinctive. But our national history has always been in a larger international context. And you know, one of the things about the Loyalist refugees is that American influences through these people ended up spreading out across the world. And it's just a really important reminder that our history has always been bound up with the histories of other nations.
Maya Jazanoff, thank you so much for being with us. The name of the book is Liberty's Exiles, American Loyalists in the Revolutionary World.
Great to talk with you.
When we come back, we'll explore the historic and current efforts to amend the U.S. Constitution. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Citizens in other states have begun a movement to call for a constitutional convention. What is the likelihood of these occurring? And what are the various processes that others have used in past amendments? We'll explore the historic and current efforts to amend the U.S. Constitution. We have three constitutional experts with us. Sanford Levinson joins us. He is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, and more recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Also with us is John Weil. John Weil is Dean and Professor of Political Science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, and the forthcoming Reframers, 170 Eccentric Visionary and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Also with us is Stephen Griffin. He is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane Law School. He's the author of Long Wars in the Constitution and American Constitutionalism, From Theory to Politics. Welcome to the three of you. Great to have you here on the Scholar's Circle. Let's start with the process of amending the U.S. Constitution. What is the likelihood of an amendment succeeding? Stephen Griffin?
I would just point out that in talking to John and Sandy, you're talking to two of the greatest constitutional amendment mavens in the country. Maybe it would be surprising to some, but there is somewhat of a latent consensus in the country that some kind of fundamental political reforms should be made. That doesn't mean people agree, of course, but it also doesn't mean that amendment is the only way to get there. Now, because of Citizens United, that has highlighted the issue of some decisions, the Supreme Court decisions, you can only overturn through amendment. But that's not really true of all of them. The constitutional system can work in funny ways. The general observation I would start with is that the traditional graveyard of constitutional amendments is not the states. It's Congress. You know, thousands of amendments, and we only have very few passed on to the states. And most of the amendments that have been passed on to the states have been ratified. So the big graveyard here is the supermajority rule. That's in Article 5, that requires a supermajority of the House and the Senate for any amendment to go forward.
Sandy Levinson, you have been very critical about Article 5. Why don't you put this into context for us?
You're absolutely right. Not to put too fine a point on it, I despise Article 5 because it makes it, as a practical matter, next to impossible to amend the Constitution with regard to anything that is controversial, and some people might argue even with regard to things that are genuinely important. There is no conceivable scenario under which two-thirds of the House and the Senate will vote to overrule Citizens United, which has this very strong support of almost all Republicans, just as Republicans generally have been cheerleaders for all of the cases that have gutted campaign finance reform. So I think that whatever one's views on the substance of Citizens United, it really is like throwing a message into the ocean and expecting that somebody on the other side will find it.
John Weil?
I wouldn't quite go that far. Let's start with some facts. We have 27 amendments. Steve was exactly right. We have about 12,000 proposals that have been introduced in Congress. 33 were actually proposed to the states. 27 of those were ratified. So he's absolutely right. The Congress, and particularly the Senate, is sort of the graveyard for amendments. I suppose a defender of the current decisions in the Supreme Court might argue that this is actually a testament to the power of the First Amendment, which, once adopted, takes on a life of its own and is very difficult to amend. We've only had one amendment repealed. I would say the only amendment that has significantly reduced civil liberties, the 18th Amendment, has been subsequently repealed. The other side of this is that there are some people who believe that speech and money are closely tied and are very grateful to have a system where the government cannot, and particularly where incumbents in office who tend to perpetuate themselves and for whom we do not have term limits other than for the president, often have a tremendous advantage over challengers. And I think there are many who think that the Supreme Court has actually been in the right direction.
Let's back up and do a little bit more historic context then. You've given us some numbers. How hard has it been historically to pass these 27 amendments? Were some of them not as hard? And if so, why? And if not, why not? Sandy Levinson?
I think that the easy ones to pass are where the country realized, or those actually in charge of state legislatures realized, that they made a great deal of sense. One of my favorite amendments that is almost never taught because there's no litigation about it is the 20th Amendment. The 20th Amendment is a great, great addition to the Constitution. It moved up Inauguration Day from March 4th to January 20th because I think by 1933 everybody agreed that it was crazy to have this five-month period between election and the inauguration of a new president who might very well have defeated an incumbent. So, in effect, we really didn't have a functioning government for several months. I'm very critical of keeping January 20th, but still, we got rid of March 4th. The other thing the 20th Amendment did was to get rid of what we now realize was a lunatic feature of the Constitution in terms of its practical operation. And in fact, this even came up in the recess appointment case, that under the original Constitution, Congress met only once a year in December. And so you could have literally 13 months go by between the election of the new Congress and the first time the new Congress, as against the lame duck Congress, would meet. This really made no sense by 1933, you know, regardless of what you thought earlier in our history. And the 20th Amendment got rid of that so that new Congresses now meet in January. The Presidential Disability Amendment raced through. Actually, the 17th Amendment, which is a very important amendment, raced through because the resistance to popular election of senators really was in the Senate itself, but by the time the Senate acquiesced to public opinion and the threat of a constitutional convention, which I'd like to say more about in a few minutes, it then raced through the states because most of the states had, in effect, adopted de facto a popular election.
Sandy Levinson, for people who don't know that the 17th Amendment changed the way we elect our senators, we used to select them by state legislatures, and 17th Amendment made it popular election.
And actually, there are those today associated with the Tea Party, or for that matter, Texas Governor Rick Perry, who believe the 17th Amendment was a mistake and should be repealed, and we should go back to selection by state legislatures. But the point in terms of our discussion right now is that it did basically race through. The Equal Rights Amendment is a very, very interesting example of an amendment that was thought to be, you know, a quickly ratified amendment. Something like 32 or 33 states, John would know the exact number because there really is nobody in the country who knows more about constitutional amendment than John Vile. But, you know, a lot of states ratified it very quickly, and then Phyllis Schlafly generated the quite remarkable social movement against the ERA, and as we know, even after a three-year addition to the original seven-year ratification period, it still wasn't successful. But generally speaking, though, you know, I stand ready to be corrected by John, I think that constitutional amendments either succeed fairly quickly or they go down.
John Vile?
He's absolutely right. ERA, if I remember correctly, got up to 35 states, and probably 32 of them, you know, were within the first 6 months, and I'm just pulling that out of thin air. But what I see in the amending process is I don't think that the last 10 years are necessary, or 20 years are necessarily characteristic of, I don't think it's time to do a postmortem on the amending process. If you look at our history, we had 12 that were adopted relatively quickly, two within 2 years of the meeting of the first 10, adopted as a package pretty much in 1791. Then we had a dry spell, 1803 to 1865. And, you know, I think a lot of it during that time is part of the situation now. We really didn't have a consensus on some of the major issues. I mean, we have people very passionately believing that we need campaign limits and others just as passionately believing otherwise. There was a prominent Princeton professor, I suppose still is, who opposed or thought we needed a traditional marriage amendment. And we had something similar, you know, 1868 to 1913, we had no amendments, and then we got four amendments adopted in a relatively quick period, you know, reflected the progressive eras. I do get the feeling that there is a rising sort of tide of people who are willing to reconsider the Article 5 convention mechanism. The first book I ever wrote was on proposals to rewrite the Constitution, and I came up, that was in 1991, and I came up with like 40 proposals. I have a book coming out at the end of next month called Reframers, in which I discovered about 175, and the sad thing is I've discovered probably another 20 since the book was written. They seem to be coming out one or two a month now, and some of them, it's titled Eccentric, Visionary, and Patriotic Proposals, and some of them probably fit the eccentric more than they do the visionary. But nonetheless, there are people on, you know, all sides of the political spectrum who are, I think, starting to re-examine whether this might be a viable possibility.
John Vile, I think it was in your new book in which you outlined the times in which even presidents were advocating for changing. Sadie Levinson has also talked about in his work where right now we're in this state of it's really not appropriate to criticize the Constitution if you're an elected official, whereas historically we've had elected officials saying we need to make some changes.
Ronald Reagan and Gingrich and, you know, that group, part of what they were advocating, and, you know, sometimes you wonder if they really wanted an amendment or if they preferred to have the issues out there to argue about, but they favored anything from prayer in school to balanced budget and several other proposals.
Stephen Griffin, you looked a lot at the framers as well.
I see the same, roughly the same history that John Vile does through the 19th century. Might disagree, I don't know, on the 20th. Suppose we define contemporary times as roughly the last 100 years. Then we have distinct periods, that's right, where we get a bunch of amendments, and many of the most significant ones are passed in the progressive era. That's where we get not only direct election of senators and votes for women and prohibition, too. But then later on, it seems that the only amendments we pass and the 1960s were themselves a significant period of constitutional change, at least in terms of amendments. But all of them are directed at pretty specific problems, where, as Sandy says, there's a consensus, and so they go through without much trouble. But the big outlier there is the ERA. And I think the ERA bears study, because the ERA is the only recent example of an amendment, I'm happy to be corrected, that tried to put a principle into the Constitution rather than solve a specific problem, like the problem that Sandy referred to of the date of inauguration. Okay, that's a very specific problem. The ERA was trying to put a principle in the Constitution, and it was doing so at a time when people were very upset, some people, about the activism of the Supreme Court, and people started to think about what would it mean if the Supreme Court, in effect, got a hold of another general principle. So that has, to me, changed the situation. So it's not so easy anymore to think about broad-scale principle change through amendments. And I think Bruce Ackerman, another scholar who's written a lot about the amendment process, is accurate when he says we've got out of the habit of constitutional amendments, talking about them. And if that's true, I think there's a lot of truth to that. The failure of the ERA was a big part of that. When that went down, a lot of the tradition of putting principles in the Constitution that arguably goes back to the Bill of Rights and Reconstruction, that kind of went down too, because any other principles, especially rights principles, would run into the same objection, namely, what's the Supreme Court going to do with that? Now, when I say that there could be a rising tide, I'm really not even talking, though, about principles in terms of rights. I mean, there's just a lot more interest in, we've got a dysfunctional political system, let's try to solve it. But at least that's something that, where if the amendment process were foreclosed by it's too difficult, it's a supermajority and all that, there are actually other ways to get at various problems of our political system other than through amendment, so it's not a hopeless quest.
Before we discuss some of these dysfunctions, talk about these informal processes that can produce the kind of change. Obviously, it's not a formal process, but it seems to change the meaning of the Constitution rather than amending the actual Constitution. Would you say that's true?
I'm a big fan of studying informal change. There are certain things, of course, you can only do through amendment, but the filibuster is a really good example. It's a kind of tired example now, but it's a really good example of something that is absolutely not in the Constitution. It's not in the plan. It's really hard to make an argument even that more supermajoritarianism is good for the legislative process when it wasn't part of the plan to begin with. But at the same time, it is a historical practice. It's lasted a long time. So it's an institutional practice that suddenly changes. Because of changes in the political system, it metastasizes. It becomes much more significant than it ever was, and its very nature changes. It's not about Mr. Smith, Jimmy Stewart, you know, standing up and talking for 24 hours until he collapses. It's really an institutional change in the Senate where both sides are agreed, yeah, we're agreeing that you absolutely need 60 votes to move anything. And yet this happens without any public discussion. But that is a vulnerability for the people who like this. There are people who think that it's a good idea to have that kind of supermajoritarian principle. I don't obviously think it's a good idea at all, but that's a really good example of a pressure point, where if you got rid of it, a significant difference would result, and you can get rid of it without a constitutional amendment.
Sandy Levinson.
I think that your listeners ought to know that there's a very, very active campaign occurring throughout the country to generate an Article 5 constitutional convention through the petition of the states. When people think of Article 5, they almost invariably think of two-thirds of the Senate and the House, and then three-quarters of the states, but two-thirds of each House of Congress, because that, in fact, is how all the 27 amendments got to the states in the first place. But Article 5 very deliberately includes another pathway to proposal, which is through a constitutional convention that is called on petition of two-thirds of the states. There's an active campaign underway, largely dominated by political conservatives who want a balanced budget amendment. And they believe, quite correctly, that there is no real prospect of a balanced budget amendment getting through the Senate. The high point of that possibility was in the 1980s when they actually got two-thirds minus one. Mark Hatfield, the Republican senator from Oregon, voted against the proposal, and it didn't go to the states. I think most people believe that the current Congress would not, in fact, propose an amendment. But John might know the actual number of states who have filed petitions for an Article 5 convention. Now, it opens a huge Pandora's box of legal questions. Do all the states have to agree on every dotted I and cross T on what the petition says? Most importantly, can states call for a limited convention that could consider only a balanced budget amendment? Or would any convention be as open as the 1787 convention was to put everything on the table? My own view is that any convention is an unlimited convention. That doesn't bother me as much as it bothers most of my friends and family. But I can tell you that if we ever get to the 34th state that agrees that there ought to be a new convention for the purpose of considering a balanced budget amendment, then there would instantly be discussion and perhaps even litigation on whether the convention could be limited. And a number of the petitions, I believe, very explicitly say that the state legislature supports a new convention if and only if it can be limited. But this is going on right now. There are significant, substantial people, and I think money, being devoted to it. And I will say that as a person who doesn't share the conservative politics, I actually am kind of rooting this on because I think it would be very good to shake up public opinion and public discussion by having to discuss whether we need some genuinely fundamental change in the constitutional system. But don't forget state petitions. Congress might be hopeless, but state legislatures could turn out to be very, very interesting political actors in the next year or two.
John Vial.
I really appreciate my colleagues and how complimentary they've been. I actually disagree with Sandy in believing that we could have a limited convention, although there are a lot of ifs, ands, and buts, and a lot of complications. One thing that I think is interesting that maybe is even under the radar of what we're seeing, although the balanced budget is sort of the tip of the spear in the calls for conventions, I have found it surprising how many people also really want to reconfigure federalism. And, of course, many people would argue that what they're trying to do is get back to the founders. But, I mean, there are proposals that Supreme Court justices from the states could, within a year, revoke federal legislation. There are any number of proposals like that that are also part of this movement. And I do think that it's a fairly strong movement. That being said, we've had at least three occasions on history where we got close and didn't do it. And one was the 17th Amendment, and some people think it was one of the prompts for Congress. But then there was a similar movement in the 1960s in reaction to the reapportionment decision. And then, as Sandy says, you know, particularly right now, the balanced budget and other federal concerns are very prominent.
You've all mentioned the states and the actions that the states can take. I know that some states and cities have been passing resolutions along these lines. The state of California passed a resolution, I think, supporting a constitutional amendment to try to overturn the Supreme Court opinion via constitutional amendment. Is this significant at all, Sandy?
I got in the mail an issue of the Arkansas Law Review that published a lecture that I gave on what I call neo-nullification, and for that matter, neo-secessionism, that is alive and well in the United States today. By neo-nullification, I mean attempts by state legislatures in particular, but also some city councils, to do whatever they can to make enforcement of federal law impossible. Some of them quite grandiosely, and I think altogether implausibly, believe that they do have the authority genuinely to nullify a federal law, and I think that's nonsense. But Heather Gerken, who teaches at the Yale Law School, coined the term uncooperative federalism, which I think is a wonderful term because it gets at the reality that the modern American state depends for its effective administration on the willingness of states and localities to be part of the same governmental team. And to the extent that, well, my own city of Austin is considering a proposal, which I frankly support, to stop cooperating with federal immigration authorities with regard to holding illegal aliens who have been arrested for a traffic violation or something else, so that the federal authorities can round them up and then deport them. New Orleans, where Steve lives, I think also has engaged in the same kind of resistance. It's not what John Calhoun would have called nullification, but I think that this is an important aspect of contemporary politics where at times it really is hard to tell the players without a scorecard in terms of traditional left-right divisions, that on gun policy, it's the right wing that wants to declare that federal gun laws are unenforceable. But with regard to immigration policy, you are discovering that there are some people associated with the left who say, now, wait a minute, we should do whatever we can to torpedo federal legislation that the Supreme Court, no doubt, believes is perfectly constitutional.
Stephen Griffin.
The common pattern here is that because of dysfunction, gridlock, whatever you want to call it, at the national level, there's a lot of policy ferment going on in the states. And immigration is a really good example of where it maybe trends a little liberal out of frustration of non-action. But a lot of it is conservative, and you didn't have, let's say, a big budget agreement getting us back on the road, let's say, to surpluses. And that just feeds discontent at the state level. Now, people do have this outlet, and it's a good outlet, and I don't actually think we would face a runaway convention. My thinking on that has shifted a little bit. But, you know, people in Washington need to pay attention to this.
John Vile.
I did not know about this example from Austin, but it reminds me of, we always associate federalism with the Southern cause, but long before federalism, we had the Hartford Convention, you know, where the New England states were considering moving away. And we also had, you know, many northern states who were very reluctant, understandably, to enforce the Fugitive Slave Clause. So this is not a new phenomenon. If we go back to the founders' intentions, when you read through the debates at the Constitutional Convention, the interesting thing about the Article 5 Convention is that it was when they almost got through and they had a proposal essentially where amendments would all depend on Congress. And George Mason and others said, of course, they didn't have experience in knowing what the new Congress was going to do. But, you know, what if it turns out to be tyrannical? Are we going to leave them, you know, with all power? And the Article 5 amending process or the convention process from right or left does indicate that if Congress is unresponsive, and, you know, this is a lesson for them, if they are unresponsive, there are alternate means that can be used.
Stephen Griffin, John Vile, Sanford Levinson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We, the People, Can Correct It, and more recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. John Vile is dean and professor of political science at Middle Tennessee State University. He's the author of The Writing and Ratification of the U.S. Constitution, Practical Virtue in Action, Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, and the forthcoming Reframers, 170 Eccentric, Visionary, and Patriotic Proposals to Rewrite the U.S. Constitution. Stephen Griffin is a professor of constitutional law at Tulane Law School. He's the author of Long Wars in the Constitution and American Constitutionalism from Theory to Politics. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.